really merit any commentary. I mean, let me recall that the Crimea is Ukraine.
No one has yet claimed responsibility, but some analysts say the move was a strategic mistake.
The threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming more and more real. And I think it wasn't wise, it was really provocative to attack the bridge, especially military. Whoever did it, they haven't reached any significant result because the bridge resumed functioning the very same day.
12 months ago, EU agency the European Court of Auditors determined Ukraine is corrupt to the core. Despite this, the nation is set to become part of the EU's long-term budget. The European Commission says Kiev needs 3.5 billion euro per month to run the country.
Since the beginning of the war, we have supported Ukraine financially with, as Team Europe, with up to 19 billion euros. This is not including the military capability and equipment support.
Fighting intensified on Monday as Russia's military struck Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. The latest position from the West's perspective is due to become clearer later this week when a meeting of NATO defence ministers takes place here in the Belgian capital. Also, an EU leaders' summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A study presented by the Bank of Italy on Monday raised the alarm on the Italian company's sentiment on the future. According to the report, based on information gathered between August 15 and September 15, spiraling inflation and uncertainty linked to the conflict in Ukraine have badly dented optimism. The Bank of Italy surveyed companies in the industrial and service sectors with at least 50 employees.
Bank of Italy's data was somehow predictable. One just needs to talk to people to realize how worrying the situation is. Maybe we must be aware that the financialization of the economy, a long-standing issue, is aggravating the economic situation and that companies must stop seeking high profits in a short span of time.
A third of the firms surveyed said difficulties related to rising energy costs had worsened in the previous 3 months, sparking a downward revision in the investment plans for the remainder of the year. The war between Ukraine and Russia has made an Italian energy crisis much worse. Italy received 40% of its gas imports before the conflict from Russia.
We are witnessing a spike in energy prices, which is only partially due to a shortage of supplies and also has roots in speculative strategies which threaten thousands of companies and alarm families.
The leader of a right-wing coalition that won elections about 2 weeks ago, Giorgia Meloni, is likely to become Italy's next prime minister. Meloni will face no shortage of challenges, from the budget and recovery plans to finding unity with allies and deciding how to handle the Ukraine-Russia war. So far, the Mario Draghi's government has spent 66 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs. Italy's finances are set to be further put to the test as analysts predict the next government will be forced to increase fiscal aid or even to resort to a budgetary slippage. Max Civilli, Rome.
Dressed in their Sunday's best and singing words of praise, thousands of Muslims from around the world descended upon the northwest English town of Bolton to celebrate a historical figure whose legacy transcends time and space. Prophet Muhammad, his birthday called the Maulid, celebrated in the third month of the Islamic calendar.
For these Muslims and millions of others around the world, Prophet Muhammad is an ethical and spiritual role model, and commemorating his life is another way of keeping his memory alive in the collective Muslim consciousness.
And it is that and his many other characteristics which attract these Muslims to the joyous occasion. The young are eager to tell us what the Prophet means to them.
Inspiration, and undoubtedly the most honest person you can ever think of. The best of all mankind, and the one you should actually truly believe in. Like, you can say, oh, I believe in this person because he's a good man, good job. This person is the one you can really say, and with your heart and faith, say, I believe in him.
He means everything to me. He showed me how to live my life, how to treat other people. You know, how the way I'd want to be treated is the same way I treat other people.
As well as making the Prophet and his legacy a constant in the lives of Muslims, the event sets out to change misconceptions among non-Muslims in the wake of insults against the Prophet in Europe in recent years and increased religious hate crimes on his followers.
Our religion that the beloved Prophet Muhammad has given it is a religion of peace, love and harmony, and it's to build unity and community, to bring the communities together with love and harmony.
At the same time as their female counterparts celebrating in a nearby building, the men engage in prayers and reciting the Quran, followed by delicious free food, a symbol of the Holy Prophet's largesse. Sai Puriza, Bolton.
The Silicon Valley of Iran, Paradis Technology Park, is home to heavyweight tech firms, from fintech to medical and robotics companies. The 20th Paradis Annual Summit, Paradis Park acknowledged the top brands that have made major contributions to the country's economic growth.
We produce mining, drilling, and extraction machinery, including road headers, side dump loaders, conveyors, bolts, as well as junction boxes. Our products are built based on international standards. We're planning to export to other countries, starting from Turkey.
We're producing all of the supplements and medicines that have a high degree of technology based on biotechnology or human medicines, veterinary medicines, and so on.
Located in west of Tehran, Paradis Technology Park was launched in 2001 with the aim of offering financial and consulting support to small enterprises and commercializing their products. Currently, it has 400 companies under its belt, many of which have turned into tech giants.
Inside the park, we try to provide many kind of facilities and services for these companies. Some of them are professional services, including, for example, some kind of consultancies like as legal and financial consultancies, providing some kind of services for them for...
Paradis Technology Park predicts that this year, the total export of products from its firms will hit the $50 million mark.
These companies now are exporting to more than 30 countries all over the world, and the number of products which are exporting now is more than 100 high-tech products. And this is a brilliant achievement for us in this situation, and also according to the sanction, these companies now are exporting to other countries.
With U.S. sanctions still haunting the Iranian economy, the country has in recent years attached greater significance to domestic brands. The government is increasingly supporting companies active in non-oil sectors as part of efforts to reduce its dependence on crude revenues, which have faced a slump in the wake of U.S. sanctions.
Each one of these brands started out as a small startup and later grew to make a name for themselves in the market. Paradis Tech Park says it continues to support knowledge-based companies and help them develop, as it believes this will lead to a more resilient economy that will be safe from the ups and downs of the oil sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him. The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abd al-Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the holy book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance.
I call on the coalition of aggressors to end their war and lift the blockade and to end their occupation of our land. Just as I call on our Yemeni people to continue their resistance against our enemies for as long as their aggression continues. We consider this to be an Islamic duty and a holy war that we must commit to.
The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
An Israeli soldier was killed in Al-Quds. This occurred after four Palestinians were shot dead in an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Now, whether these incidents are related remains to be seen, but at this point it shows that when a Palestinian wants to act against Israeli forces, it can do so, aside from this being a reaction due to Israeli repression. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the Israeli-Palestinian conflict remains at the heart of the decades-old conflict in West Asia and how Israel continues its flagrant violations of Palestinians. First, let's cross on over to occupied Ramallah and talk to Mona Kandil about what has occurred. Mona, at this point, tell us the numbers that have been injured, both on the Palestinian side or killed, and also on the Israeli side, and where things stand at this point.
Well, we have to mention that the manhunt for the Palestinian man, or the suspect, Israeli state, who is behind the shooting, is still underway. Yesterday, a Palestinian get out of a vehicle at a military checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat refugee camp in Al-Quds and opened fire at the Israeli soldiers stationing there, killing an Israeli female soldier and wounding others. At least two are in serious condition. The Israelis claimed that the man the identity of the man was revealed from the Shafat refugee camp. The Israeli soldiers succeeded, unfortunately, to arrest four Palestinians. One of them is the brother of this man who carried out the shooting, as the Israeli military is saying. Both all the four Palestinians who were arrested denied any information. They say that they didn't know that the man would be carrying out a shooting. They said that they stopped the vehicle at the checkpoint. He get out of the vehicle and opened fire. All the entrances, we have to say, leading to Shafat refugee camp were completely closed by the Israeli forces. More Israeli soldiers were sent there. Clashes have taken place between Palestinian residents of the Shafat refugee camp, as well as the residents of Anata, the nearby Palestinian town, with the Israeli soldiers. Up till the moment, the manhunt is underway, and the entrances to Shafat refugee camp and Anata town are completely closed. A number of Palestinian groups said that they are responsible for the shooting, but at the same time, experts and the Israeli military believe that this man carried out the shooting by himself and they know that he was not affiliated to any of the Palestinian resistance groups.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mona Kandil there from Occupied Ramallah. Thank you.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Moti Abu Musaba is a Palestinian political activist that joins us from Gaza City. Also joining us is Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who joins us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me first get an idea from you, Mick Napier, about what has occurred. I mean, we're looking at a brazen attack. The person who decided to do this, which is said to be a revenge attack. It's almost confirmed. A correspondent also confirmed that, where an Israeli soldier was killed. The fact that this person took matters into his hands and went out and did this obviously is one side of the story. But the reasons as to why this has occurred is where we'd like to get a reaction from you on this.
Well, reasons work at several different levels. When we talk about a revenge attack, Israel has been on a killing spree. And it believes that it can kill. It's been young teenagers recently they've been focusing on, quite a few of them children. But Israel believes that it can kill these Palestinians with relative impunity in the West Bank, because they have saturated the area with soldiers, with the world's most advanced surveillance equipment. And therefore they think that the Palestinians are, to use the disgusting language of an earlier Israeli general, are like drugged cockroaches in a bottle, which is what they thought they could reduce the Palestinians to. But they're not drugged and they're not cockroaches. And it's very difficult for the Israelis to cope with the kind of resistance which we've just seen, where a heroic young man, possibly not connected to any other resistance groups, but certainly, I would imagine, influenced by the current developments and changes in tactics of those resistance groups, the resurgence, not just in Jenin, but spilling over into other areas in the West Bank. He couldn't help but be lifted by this. And the fact that he's been able, nonchalantly, you would almost imagine that he was trained militarily, but that he could emerge from a car and inflict such damage on this massively highly equipped army, which has been terrorizing the West Bank successfully to a degree for a very long time, is quite remarkable. And you have to explain it, not just in terms of whether he himself has suffered family members killed or brutalization. This is the small change of life in the West Bank. But whether he feels that the alternative is simply doom, not just for him personally, but for the Palestinian people. Because the Israelis make no secret that their plan is a Palestine without Palestinians. And therefore, given the lack of any alternative to resistance other than humiliation and degradation, increasing numbers of people are choosing the route of armed resistance. How that will go, it's impossible from my armchair to predict. But it's certainly a devastating surprise for the Israelis that Palestinians, after everything they've been through, still resist, and so successfully.
The point that our guest there from Edinburgh makes, Moti Abu Musaba, is a very important one, I think. And I'm wondering what you think about that, and that is the fact that you have somebody that is not related to any particular resistance group, but is a lone person who has decided to react based on the fact that Israel has killed Palestinians and carried out the operation. And that's quite remarkable, because many are now subscribing to that method. Do you think that this is something that is going to keep on increasing as time goes by?
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to join you once again. In fact, there is, I think, a wide consensus that the resistance actions against the Israeli occupation and the recent days actually are remarkably increasing. And in my opinion, there are many, there are multiple reasons behind that. The first one is the ongoing and the relentless Israeli suppression and aggression practice against the Palestinians in the West Bank. Today, as you know, the bloodshedding of the Palestinians there is continued since the beginning of this year. As you have mentioned, that since the beginning of this year, 2022, more than 100 Palestinians were killed and murdered by the Israeli occupation in front of the whole world. Needless to mention, the ongoing raids and the continuous storming of Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank, especially in Nablus and Jenin City. Actually, this goes hand in hand with the deteriorating situation of the economic conditions and the humanitarian conditions. According to the latest records, the unemployment rate actually surpasses 70% among the Palestinian youths there. So this actually ignites the tension on the West Bank. Actually, let's be clear that on the other hand, beside that or in addition to that, Israel deliberately tries to build more and more settlements. Israel tries to create a new de facto on the ground. There is some important an important issue and important reason behind that, which is the ongoing Israeli violations practiced in Al-Aqsa Yards, which actually, as you know, adds fuel to the fire in the West Bank, because the Palestinian people there are watching the Israeli provocations against the Palestinian citizens, against the Palestinian women, and elderly there, which actually adds fuel to the fire and increase the tension among those youths. So amid all those provocations, amid all those attacks and aggressions, the Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to defend themselves.
Indeed, those are some very good points that you make in terms of the right to react there. But, you know, what is somewhat interesting here is how the interpretation is made, McNabb, here, when it comes to the way Israel describes the situation. In this case, in point, the Israeli military says that it opens fire only when it's in life-threatening situations. That kind of brings back the explanation given during the last war, where you have the U.S. and the EU come out and say Israel has the right to defend itself. Isn't that code for Israel to shoot and kill?
Of course. And not only will the green light be shone from Washington or Berlin or London, but they will also supply the means for the killing. Look, Israel is very adept at propaganda. It doesn't seem to work with the great majority of people in Europe, actually, but they're still very adept at it. Israel has been caught officers killing children. I myself spoke to the father of a 13-year-old schoolgirl, quite famous was the case, Iman al-Hams, because of an accident recording the soldiers talking. And the officer told his soldiers to kill anything in the area, even if it was 3 years old. And that was played on Israeli television. I was looking through some old anniversaries yesterday and came upon the example, I was shocked, but I don't know why, of the Israeli general who found a group of Egyptians during one of the wars, and they were captives, they were quarry workers, they were not soldiers, they were completely unarmed. And the story is not that he killed all of them, he did, he slaughtered these civilians, but that much later he boasted about it in the Israeli media. And there was no backlash. There were no charges, no investigation. So if you murder civilians, Egyptian or Palestinian, Lebanese or whatever, and then boast about what you have done in Israel, you can do this with complete impunity. So the Americans have an intelligence agency, so do the British. It's not that they don't know. They know exactly the barbarity of the Israelis. They know this because they've studied it. And for a very short time, the British were on the receiving end of it, very short before they restructured the alliance. So they know exactly what Israel's doing in terms of killing children, deliberately killing children. There have been UN reports in the last couple of years which say very clearly Israel is indiscriminately killing civilians in Gaza at that time and is indiscriminately killing children. During the Great March of Return, the UN reported that Israel was killing journalists, medical workers, and children, and it said, knowing that they were children and knowing who they were. So there's no secret. You don't have to be a radical or a dissident. Anybody who wants to find out can find this out from unimpeachable resources. Sure. What the Palestinians live under is a most barbaric and murderous regime. And that explains one thing. People under colonial domination, the naked violence, let's say, which what colonialism is, many people just try to live, you know. They don't want to fight. There's a minority who want to fight. There's a minority who want to collaborate always. But most people in the middle just try to feed their families and live and put up with some humiliation. But they begin to resist in the mass when they realize that they cannot live in this way, that the Israelis will not allow them to live in this way, that the humiliation and the killings will be incessant and will increase until Palestinians are driven out. So we can look at the tactics of the resistance. They're very impressive. They're changing in a way that they've evolved tactics which are keeping the Israelis wrong-footed. But the rising resistance can be laid at the door, one, of the Israelis, and two, of the indomitable Palestinian ability to absorb tremendous punishment and still continue to resist. Can I just add one thing?
Go ahead.
100 Palestinians killed, and they've managed to kill, I think, 19 or 20 Israelis. Now, that's horrible, and I don't want to sound callous. But, you know, normally in an anti-colonial resistance, it can be 100 to 1. In Vietnam, it was 60 to 1. You know, in Algeria, it was roughly 100 Algerians killed for every French occupier. So what the Palestinian resistance is achieving at very high cost, I don't want to minimize the cost, is quite remarkable.
Yeah, you both have talked about this figure, which is accurate in terms of 100 being killed. And what is really, really sad about this figure, that this is five times as many Palestinians that have been killed in the same period in 2021, where we mentioned 100. So bad that the UN Human Rights Chief, Michel Bachelet, has expressed alarm at the high number of Palestinians, including children, that have been killed and or injured in the occupied Palestinian territory this year. Muta Abu Musaba, why do you think that Israel has put his killing machine, as some call it, in high gear this year?
Yes, as you know, that the Israeli occupation forces are trying to impose a new de facto on the ground. They are racing counter the clock to impose the new realities on the ground, to seize more Palestinian lands. Armed with the open American support and the abhorrent silence of the international community towards those crimes. So Israel, as good as possible, tries to suppress more Palestinians, to steal more Palestinian lands, trying to exploit the tumultuous region and the instability and the global fronts, especially with regard to the Ukrainian and Russian crisis nowadays. But anyway, as you know, that Palestinians would never allow the Israelis the Israeli occupation to keep committing its crimes without any punishment or without any response. And actually what is going on the ground with this regard actually reveals the hypocrisy of the international community and the U.S. administration that speaks up when it comes to the Ukrainian issue, when it comes to the Ukrainian regions annexed by the Russian forces and the Russian government. They are speaking up and trying to denounce that kind of annexation. But when it comes to the Palestinian people, we are witness and we are witnessing how the Israeli occupation forces are annexing the Palestinian or have been annexing the Palestinian lands for more than seven decades without having any response from the international community or the U.S. administration. Actually, this reveals clearly how hypocrite and how biased the international community to the Israeli occupation at the expense of the Palestinian people. Today, the Palestinian people, amid all that kind of bias, have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to prevent the Israeli occupation from committing its crimes.
Well, this is the problem here, McNapier, that I see it being a problem of perception that the Israelis, backed by their media conglomerates that they control, always paint the picture that they are being the victim. For example, if you have a Palestinian that attacks them, that Palestinian is called a terrorist. But when you have one of their security sources or forces, kill a Palestinian, then they're defending Israel's security. Our guests have talked about the Ukraine conflict. Again, a matter of perception. Who's being the aggressor there? Is Russia being the aggressor, or are they being the ones that were being provoked and being cornered after 6 years of a war, for example? And I'm using that just as a comparative analysis there. This view of the perception is what we're looking at. But do you think slowly but surely Israel is losing that battle because so many people are becoming aware of the Palestinian cause?
No, I don't think that Israel is slowly losing the battle. I don't think so at all. I think if you study the numbers, polls commissioned by the European Union, recent polls in America, for that matter, in the last few weeks, Israel long ago lost the battle for public opinion. And it's very important to note that. It's not what I want to believe. It's what anybody who looks at the results of public opinion studies must conclude, that by their resistance, Palestinians have been able to defeat Israel in the court of public opinion. Now, I don't mean in terms of what's allowed to be discussed publicly in Britain or Germany or America. That's a different matter. People who I have spent years in court on criminal charges for Palestine advocacy. There's an attempt to silence people here, just as there is to call human rights groups in the West Bank terrorist groups. Israel does it there. Our governments do it here. But in terms of what people believe, they already are deeply suspicious of Israel. An opinion poll after opinion poll shows that Israel is deeply unpopular, viewed as sinister, viewed as a thug and a bully by popular opinion. Now, that needs to be translated into active energy, boycott, divestment and sanctions around the world. But that's the reality we start with. So I don't think Israel's slowly losing it. It's very important to understand they lost it a long time ago and they have never recovered public support. It's gone. It's gone completely.
Okay, we need to talk about the Islamic Jihad, and they actually have supported what has happened because of the bravery of the person that came out and did this. So my question to you, Muti Abu Musab, was just the founding anniversary that was held a few days back in Gaza by the Islamic Jihad, and on display were some new military equipment and some other various forms of military equipment in addition to the new ones. Are we looking at Israel taking note of the Islamic Jihad, its strength that's been elevated, increased compared to the past, including other resistance groups like Hamas, and seeing that they are not at a strong point when it comes to the armed aspect, when it comes to, for example, resistance groups vis-a-vis Israel and their forces?
Yes, as you know that today the Palestinian resistance factions actually are standing united in the front of the Israeli occupation, and they are races counter the clock to develop their abilities and to enhance their abilities to confront the Israeli occupation crimes. Today it's just a matter of time for any kind of escalation to break out between the Palestinian resistance factions and the Israeli occupation forces, especially amid the ongoing and the relentless Israeli crimes and violations, which actually which actually makes any kind of a new escalation or a new round of escalation is so close. Amid all these conditions, the Palestinian resistance factions, especially or led by Hamas movement and the Islamic Jihad, are obliged to be united in front of the Israeli occupation to have a strong unity. We as Palestinians realize that we cannot face the Israeli occupation separately or divided. The strategic choice we have here is to keep maintaining our unity in front of the Israeli occupation and to develop our abilities to confront the Israeli occupation forces.
Thank you for that. Sorry, we're fresh out of time. That's Mick Napier there, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Thank you. Muti Abu Musaba, pleasure, Palestinian political activist from Gaza City. Thank you so much. And we had Mona Kandil at the top of the hour, our correspondent from Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikova Tavley and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Medina and mentions the complaint of a woman whose husband had put her away by resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as Zahar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children, and without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Prophet against this unjust behavior and said she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted, and this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet or fall to the temptations of the Satan or lie in their oaths and make intrigues against the Prophet will be defeated and suffer humiliation both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the party of Allah, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. We start from where we left you last Friday in our last episode of this series, and here are ayahs 18 and 19 of the said surah.
يوم يبعثهم الله جميعا فيحلفون له كما يحلفون لكم ويحسبون أنهم على شيء ألا إنهم هم الكاذبون استحوذ عليهم الشيطان فأنساهم ذكر الله أولئك حزب الشيطان ألا إن حزب الشيطان هم الخاسرون
The day when Allah will raise them all together, they will swear to Him, just like they swear to you, O Prophet, supposing that they stand on something. Look, they are indeed liars. Satan has prevailed upon them, so he has caused them to forget the remembrance of Allah. They are Satan's confederates. Look, indeed it is Satan's confederates who are the losers. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the stratagem of the hypocrites is to undermine Islam by claiming to be Muslim in order to prevent the proper promotion in society of God's commandments. Of course, this is nothing but foolishness on the part of the hypocrites to think of themselves as clever and smart when their end is utter humiliation, both in the transient life of this world and in the hereafter. An important point to note is that wealth, power, and children may be of help in the world, but will be of no avail in the hereafter. The ayahs that we recited to you now mean to say that the hypocrites resort to false oaths both while alive in this world and also when resurrected to life after death in the hereafter. Hypocrites are mistaken to think that they can save themselves from divine punishment through lying, since lying has turned into a natural disposition for them. The day of resurrection is the scene of manifestation of deeds and intentions, and even on this day, when shown their evil deeds at the final tribunal, the hypocrites will falsely swear in the same manner that they used to swear false oaths in the transient life of the mortal world. The next ayah says the hypocrites have allowed Satan to completely dominate them to the extent they have forgotten God Almighty and His blessings. They have become the confederates or party of the Satan whose deception has totally absorbed them. In other words, the more a person drifts away from God, the more he or she is entrapped by Satan. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, whoever heeds the temptations of the Satan will become a member of his party and thus become a loser in both the transient life of the mortal world and on the day of resurrection, where nothing can save him or her. And number two, if a person becomes a habitual liar, this habit of lying will continue even after resurrection on the Day of Judgment. Now let us listen to ayahs 20 and 21 of the same surah.
إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يُحَادُّونَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ أُولَئِكَ فِي الْأَذَلِّينَ كَتَبَ اللَّهُ لَأَغْلِبَنَّ أَنَا وَرُسُلِي إِنَّ اللَّهَ قَوِيٌّ عَزِيزٌ
Indeed, those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, they will be among the most abased. Allah has ordained, surely I and my prophets will prevail. Indeed, Allah is all strong, almighty. Here it is stressed that the hypocrites and the disbelievers are the most abased people since they disobey the Almighty Creator's commands and ridicule the prophets. As Ayah 21 means to say, such persons will never succeed and victory belongs solely to God and His prophets, even if the enemies happen to temporarily silence the voice of the messengers of God through imprisonment and murder. These ayahs teach us that, number one, disbelief, denial of truth and hypocrisy leads to self-destruction and permanent loss in afterlife. Number two, those who oppose the manifest truth are the most abased persons. And number three, the divine promise on the final triumph of truth over falsehood will materialize in the end times with the advent of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance for establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity, and justice. At the end of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, we complete explanation of Surah Mujadila. And here is the last ayah, that is 22, in which God Almighty says,
لا تجد قوما يؤمنون بالله واليوم الآخر يوادون من حاد الله ورسوله ولو كانوا آباءهم أو أبناءهم أو إخوانهم أو عشيرتهم أولئك كتب في قلوبهم الإيمان وأيدهم بروح منه ويدخلهم جنات تجري من تحتها الأنهار خالدين فيها رضي الله عنهم ورضوا عنه أولئك حزب الله أَلَا إِنَّ حِزْبَ اللَّهِ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ
You will not find a people believing in Allah and the last day endearing those who oppose Allah and His Prophet, even though they were their own parents or children or brothers or kinsfolk. For such, He has written faith in their hearts and strengthened them with a spirit from Him, and He will admit them into gardens with streams running in them, to remain in them forever. Allah is pleased with them, and they are pleased with Him. They are Hezbollah. Look, indeed the party of Allah is the felicitous. This ayah refers to a general principle, that is the obedience to God Almighty through devotion to the prophets, imams, and saintly people, while firmly opposing the enemies of humanity. In other words, love for God and love for the enemies of humanity cannot be intermixed or assembled in one heart, even if the disbelievers happen to be the nearest of kin and blood relatives of the believers, such as parents, children, brothers, or sisters. Thus, God considers true believers whose hearts are purified with obedience solely for Him through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons as Hezbollah or party of Allah. Such people are ensured of success in the world and in the hereafter through divine assistance, which becomes more manifest in the bliss of paradise where lush gardens and fresh flowing streams are granted to them. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, true faith requires obedience to God through devotion to the teachings of the prophets, imams, and saintly persons, while fully disavowing the disbelievers, even if they happen to be the nearest of kin. Number two, love and affection of the faithful and the faithless cannot exist in one single heart, which ought to be purified of all filth in order to gain the belief. And number three, in Islam, the bonds of faith are superior to family, tribal, and even national attachments.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.